And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
And welcome, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. You have now entered into the apologetic zone, Virgin Most Powerful Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Machuda. It's great to be with you today. Great show in store for you today. We're going to have John DeRosa, the classical theist himself, come back into the dojo. You may be familiar with him. He was on the show a little while back. Actually, I think the first time was on the West Coast trip, and then he came back later on. But anyway, he's going to come back. He just came out with a new edition, or he's coming out with a new edition of his free book, Answering Atheist Slogans. Yes, there are a lot of slogans out there, just things that non-believers will throw out at believers. And you know, often we're caught by surprise. We don't really know how to give a good, solid, yet very simple, straightforward answer to those. Well, John DeRosa is going to help us work through that. So that's going to be a lot of fun. It's always great to have him on the program. And as always, we're going to have our finding of the fallacy. Today's informal fallacy is the argument from incredulity. And also we're going to meet the early church father, Justin Martyr. So great stuff in store for us today. And by the way, if you have any questions, especially for John DeRosa, you know, on theistic apologetics, give us a call, 888-526-2151. That is 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. Also, if you have rather shoot us an email instead of talk to us on air live, you can certainly do that by emailing us at questions@handsonapologetics.com. And that goes straight to the dojo mailbox, and I answer all the wonderful emails. In fact, there's lots of great emails in store. And as always on our program, we need to give a shout-out to those watching live stream on social media, such as live stream Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see familiar names there in the YouTube chat. Yes, thank you for the emojis, Elsie. Appreciate it. It's always good to have chat. So, so let's jump into our exercises. All right, Ricky. That's kind of a scary one. Is that ghost on the emojis? It's more, okay. Let's go to the finding of the fallacy for today. I need to just keep one eye on this section of dojo, people. Sometimes it gets a little crazy in the chat rooms, but it's fun when it comes to emoji craziness, but let's go to the finding of the fallacy. Today's finding of the fallacy is the argument from incredulity. And basically, it's very similar to, you could say, an appeal to common sense. Like, everybody knows that blank. Or even personal incredulity. And basically, what it does is it asserts that because something seems incredible or difficult to imagine, it's wrong. Okay, so So the arguments for incredulity or from incredulity usually take the form of, I can't imagine how X could possibly be true, therefore X must be false. Okay? So let's dive in a little bit into this. This is an interesting fallacy. In fact, it's great that we have this one with John DeRosa because this happens a lot for non-believers. Okay? They can't imagine something about God, so therefore God doesn't exist. Now, the difficulty, of course, is that, imagination is a great thing. God gives us imagination. But you have to realize that our imaginations are tied to our senses, okay, our sight, our hearing, our taste, touch, feel. We can't imagine something. We can't have a mental picture of something that doesn't come through our senses. So when we're talking about things like the soul or God or angels, immaterial things, imagination really kind of falls apart because what we try to do is attach physical, tangible qualities to something that's not physical and tangible, it's immaterial. And so whenever it comes to God, yes, you can postulate all sorts of things that you can't imagine about God. And the reason for that is because God's immaterial. So so this whole argument from incredulity that somehow I can't imagine how something would be true, therefore it's false, kind of falls apart. So that's our finding the fallacy for today, the argument from incredulity. So be aware of that, folks. And all right, so let's jump to our Meet the Early Father segment. A Meet the Early Church Father. This one's, again, one of my faves because he's a very early church father with lots of very interesting material in his writings. St. Justin the Martyr, who was born roughly around 100, 110 AD, died somewhere around AD 165. So he's very early on, so close to the time of the apostles, just shortly after the time of apostles. And St. Justin the Martyr was born in paganism in Neapolis, just outside Palestine, sometime between the year 100 and 110 AD. As a young man, he attached himself successively to various philosophical schools. He loved philosophy. First, he's a Stoic, then a Peripatetic, then a Pythagorean, then a Platonist. And eventually, there's a story of him where he got fed up with going to these schools because it seemed like none of them really spoke the truth, and plus it cost a lot of money to go to these schools. And he's walking on a beach disgruntled, and an old man comes upon him and asks him why he's sad, and he explains his plight. And the old man says, "Let me tell you about the true philosophy, the philosophy of Christ." And he tells him about Christianity, which bowls over St. Justin Martyr. And St. Justin not only becomes a Christian, but he becomes a bold apologist. Let's see. He was martyred, and there's an authentic account of his martyrdom, according to which he and six of his companions were beheaded between the years 163-167 AD, probably around 165. So a martyr for the faith, a lover of philosophy, and a defender, apologist of the faith. There are three writings that you should know about in regards to Justin Martyr. The first one, it's two of his apologies. Okay, he wrote two defenses of Christianity against pagans, and the third work is his dialogue with Trypho, the Jew. In regards to the first apology, folks, we have the first and the second apology. Now, here's where things get confusing, because whether the first apology and the second apology of Justin constitutes two different works or one is debatable. Eusebius knew that Justin had wrote two apologies and that a single manuscript mentions the present, what is called two apologies. But it's possible that the first apology is actually the first and the second one. Or perhaps we don't have the second one, and the two apologies are actually the first. And the reason for that is because when you read his first apology, okay, I probably lost everybody on that, but when you read his first apology, the first 68 chapters of this apology appear to be a single work, and then there's an appendix. The first part was written probably around 148 to 161 AD, and this was addressed to the Emperor Antoninus Pius, and then the second part was probably written about 155, and it's addressed to the Roman Senate. So that seems to be an appendix. So if you ever get a chance to read it, it's very fascinating because he gets into pagan philosophy. He shows the absurdity of pagan philosophy, and he also defends the Christian faith. And in that defense, he has some very interesting things to say about how Christians worship. You know, he actually gives a description of the early mass and all sorts of just really good material for apologetics. The other work you should be familiar with is his work on Dialogue with Trypho the Jew. Now, this Dialogue with Trypho is one of the oldest extant, in fact, it probably is the oldest extant Christian apology against Judaism, where we have a dialogue with a Christian and a Jew. It's very lengthy work, but it's worth reading, although it can kind of get into details. Trypho, by the way, There was a time where people thought that trifle was just a rhetorical device used by Justin to give a fictional dialogue. But there is good reason to believe that perhaps this actually is a real dialogue and that Trypho the Jew is a real historic person. In fact, it's likely that this particular Trypho could be identified with a certain rabbi, Terephon, which is mentioned in the Jewish Mishnah. So interesting stuff. And again, the dialogue with Trypho is fascinating dialogue. I highly recommend reading at least this first apology and also his dialogue with Trypho the Jew, because there are a lot of very interesting things. He gets into biblical arguments. He also has a very high view, by the way, of that ancient Greek translation of the Old Testament known as the Septuagint. So very good stuff. That is our Meet the Early Church Father for today, St. Justin the Martyr. And good stuff. I mean, I think, like I said, if you're going to be a defender of the faith, you need to know at least the apostolic fathers, you know, First Clement, the seven letters of Ignatius, the letter of Polycarp, things like that. But you also need to know a few of the early apologists, and certainly Justin Martyr ranks on the top of the early apologists that you need to know. And there you go. You are now armed and ready to go defend the faith. All right, coming up on the other side of the break, we have Master Apologist John DeRosa coming on board, entering into the dojo. He's going to work through with us how to answer typical atheist slogans. So stay tuned, everybody. More to come. Hands on Apologetics. I'm Gary Machuda.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Fathers, you know, that's an important segment because when you're explaining defending the faith, you need to show that our beliefs go all the way back to the time of the apostles. And the best way to do that, In fact, probably the only way to do that is to actually read later extra biblical writings, starting from the very beginning. And a lot of people are not familiar with that. We actually have Christian writings that were written during the time of the New Testament. The New Testament wasn't even completed, and we already have extra biblical writings written by Christians who knew the apostles. They were taught by the apostles. Some of them were even set over churches by the apostles. And so the apostolic context is that they actually, as the fathers say, they still had the teaching of the apostles ringing in their ears, so to speak, while they lived. So very important stuff. And like I said, Justin Martyr is very, very important early church father. Now, let's talk about atheism, shall we? There are lots of slogans out there proposed by atheists, but how do we answer them? Well, our guest, John DeRose, is on board, coming into the dojo. He has an undergraduate degree in math education at the College of New Jersey and an MA in Pure and Applied Mathematics in Montclair State University. But many of you know him through his work on the website, www.classicaltheism.com, which is an awesome website with lots of great videos and interviews on atheism, Christianity, Catholicism, great stuff, and free books, by the way. John DeRosa, welcome to Hands On Apologetics.
Gary Machuda, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for having me back today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's always good to have you on board because, after all, you are Mr. Classical Theism himself.
Well, I will say we're pretty strict at the Classical Theism podcast. We call ourselves studious amateurs. We want to come alongside the guests. We learn from great experts, content that we can present in conversation. But I'll tell you what, Gary, even though, you know, I call myself a studious amateur, I think the listeners of your show, of my show, I think they would like that label as well. But guess what? If you have that amateur label, you're already far ahead of a lot of the people out there who are criticizing the faith with these superficial slogans without really digging deep. If you have any level of understanding and you want to learn about this stuff, I think you can go a long way towards steering our young people and other people back towards the church.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I love your website. Again, it's classicaltheism, all one word.com. Because you really do, it can get pretty heady, you know, it can really go over your head, especially if you're not familiar with philosophy. And what I love about your website is that you break it down because you want it to get on the level of conversation. You're not getting into theoretical stuff. You don't really get into the weeds unless you absolutely have to, but it's very good. It's hands-on stuff, right?
Well, I'd say it's, you know, as Catholics, it's not either or, it's both and. I think we have to get, you know, raise the bar intellectually. And you know this too. Sometimes I've read your books. I've looked at those footnotes. You're diving deep into those historical sources. And sometimes you really do got to roll up your sleeves and get down into it, whether it's philosophy or history, and get pretty advanced. But then other times, you know, you got to step back and just say, okay, what are the little nuggets that I can take away to present in conversation with someone? And I want everyone to have at least that. The way we break it down at the Classical Theism Podcast is we want to defend three core pillars of the Catholic Christian worldview. We want to have some ammunition for showing that God exists, some ammunition for the fact that Jesus is Lord, and also some arguments for the fact, like you do on your segment every day, the Early Church Fathers, for showing that Jesus founded the Catholic Church historically. So if you have some information on each of those three pillars, you don't have to have all the heady stuff. You don't have to have all the advanced footnotes. I think you can do some real good work in conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, in fact, you have an ebook that you're going to, I don't know, did you do the new edition yet, or is the new edition about to come out?
So I sent out the table of contents of the new edition. So if you're on my email list, you'll see that. I haven't finished writing it yet, but the long story short is it started out with 10 slogans. Then it was 11 slogans. Now I'm up to 17 atheist slogans. I'm just going to kind of keep adding to it, Gary. And, you know, People can download it for free on the website, and hopefully it'll give them some good information. And we're going to go through some of these slogans today. Oh, I added one new tip at the beginning, too. I'm rewriting the whole thing, the introduction. So do you mind if I go through a couple preliminary principles?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so the introduction, a few things you want to know. These are answering atheist slogans. These are pithy remarks, sometimes one or two sentences. But if you're not prepared and you haven't heard them, they can really throw you off. So in the introduction, I got like four preliminary points now. One, I want you, if you're going to be talking with atheists, skeptics, anybody, you should be praying every day. You want to stay close to the Lord. You decide. This is actually in the catechism. I just found this recently. In the catechism, the section on prayer, they like put the onus on us. They say you decide the time and duration of your personal prayer each day. And, you know, I fail at this all the time, but you pick. Set it, whether it's 5 minutes, whether it's 20 minutes, whether it's more. Try to be consistent. It'll just help you, you know, just develop that closer relationship with the Lord. Because sometimes these skeptics, these atheists, especially on the internet, they can get pretty intense, and it can waver your faith a bit. So you want to be praying. And then the second two big things, and this one of them is new. First one is, this is not new, but you got to know this. If you're going into conversation, whenever possible, you want to ask questions rather than make statements.
Yes.
People who dialogue, you'll hear it on Catholic Answers, Trent Horn, Gary Machuda, you do this. Your guests who come on, they do this. You want to clarify the person's position that you're talking with and really find out more information before you dive into a defense of God, Jesus, or the church. Otherwise, you just risk talking past them. And questions also allow you to develop that rapport with the person, letting them speak first. And then the one thing I want to add to that is a new preliminary principle. Don't deal in vague generalities, but press the person for specifics. A lot of times, you know, the person might just say, oh, you know, you Christians, you got that problem of evil, right? You got that problem of suffering. Well, hey, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? Don't just let them like throw out a word or a sentence without actually giving an argument. Well, can you tell me more about that? What do you mean by the problem of suffering? Force them to spell it out specifically. And odds are, as they do that, and as you gather more information, you'll know how to better inform them, and you'll be able to point out their mistake.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and what I found, John, and I'm sure you probably discovered this as well, when you do that, you realize that the person really didn't think through their own arguments. Many times they struggle because they never thought, well, gee, what do I mean when I say this? You know?
Right. Well, you either find out one of two things. I think the vast majority of the time, yes, you find out that the person really has not done their homework. But two, sometimes you find out, hey, wait a minute, this person did their homework. They're very informed. And in that case, you can praise them for doing their homework. You could say, hey, you know what? I want to just thank you for looking into this, because I've talked to a lot of people that just dismissively make remarks and without studying it. So thank you for studying this. Let's dive into this together and talk about it. And hey, you might even have to say, I got to study this more, but I will get back to you with some good answers. But yeah, like you said, the vast majority of the time, people don't want to do their homework. They just want to sling slogans.
Yeah, exactly. And it's because slogans are easy. I mean, yes, you can come up with some pithy little, you know, bombs you could throw at people. But it, actually forming an argument and presenting evidence for that argument, that's hard. You got to roll up your sleeves.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So, in fact, one of the most disarming things about slogans for me, it always throws me off guard because, like I said, it's kind of like this prepackaged grenade. You know, you just toss it, pull the pin, toss it, and let it do the work itself. And sometimes that can keep us, you know, catch us off guard.
Because, oh, absolutely.
Yes, that's why I love this free book. And when it comes out, I'll let the listeners know when the new edition comes out, because it helps you be prepared so that, you know, if they do lob this grenade over, you can use it to for fruitful dialogue.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that gets you. I know so many people. I went to college and it, you know, the secularism is rampant and people just throw a lot of objections at you, and philosophy 101 classes, sociology, anthropology, all these classes. And if you've never heard it before, it's intimidating. And I get that. But that's kind of my thing. I'm going to keep adding to this. You know, now it's up to 17 slogans. You're going to see the one you get now. If you go on the website and get it, it's got 11. But if you've heard these things before, if you've done a little prep work, then you could demystify them and you don't have to be afraid, because you're like, hey, I saw a Twitter post the other day. Somebody, I can't remember who said it, but they were like saying, you know, when you think of an objection, They were talking to skeptics and atheists. They're like, when you think of an objection, like, how can a good God make a hell? Or how can someone allow the suffering and evil of this? Just think that there's been 2,000 years of Christian intellectuals who have been thinking about these things. So at the very least, there's going to be some answer out there, even if it doesn't come to mind initially. But for my part, I want to just give people some initial information that they don't have to be afraid of these slogans, and they can respond with good questions and good facts.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can literally take a grenade and make it into a slow pitch baseball that you can knock out of the park.
I like that. Well, and I'm happy to do that today. Gary, you have free form here. You can pick any of these slogans you want. We can give the listeners a taste, or even if you think of ones that aren't on the list, and I'll do my best here as a studious amateur to give you some good replies.
Okay, well, we have about 3 minutes, so let's try to let's just do the first one, just to start things off, that there's no evidence for the existence of God.
Yeah, so this is popular. You're going to hear it. There's no evidence for God's existence. There's no scientific evidence. There's no empirical evidence. There's no evidence. Start with asking questions. And listeners who have tuned into my show or your show, they've probably heard me say this before. I like to start with this one with what I call the Trent Horn question. And I return to it in some other slogans as well. It goes like this. I got it from Trent Horn. You ask that person, what's the best evidence or argument you've ever heard for God's existence? And what do you think is wrong with it? Start by asking that question, because if someone just throws out there's no evidence for God's existence, well, hey, in your mind, if you listen to Hands-On Apologetics, you're like, wait a minute, I know all these arguments, I've read these books, I've thought about these things. Well, and it's very tempting to just start launching into a defense of God's existence, but no, take a step back. You want to see, what has this person studied? Ask them, what's the best argument you've heard, and what's wrong with it? I think they can give three types of answers. One, they can respond with awe. Well, I've never heard any evidence for God's existence. And if that's the case, you have your one or two go-to arguments. You could say, oh my gosh, you've never heard anything? Well, hey, can I offer you the Kalam cosmological argument? Can I offer you the moral argument or the first way? What do you think about these? Because I've heard at least four or five good arguments for God's existence. And then you could start talking about one. Or they might respond with what I call, so that's the first thing. They respond, they've never heard any evidence. Second thing, they've only heard weak evidence, as I call it. They might say, oh, well, you know, some Christians I heard, they told me once that they prayed for something and it came true. Or, you know, I heard that people look at, you know, the design and the animal kingdom and they think that, you know, that must have been done by God. But we already know evolution did that. So they offer only those types of things, like either some personal subjective experience or, you know, some old design argument like the watchmaker from Paley. And in that case, you can respond, well, I'll finish that off on the other side of the break.
Yeah. Hey, that's a great cliffhanger. We're talking with John DeRosa about answering atheist slow. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. We'll be right back.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome, everybody, back to the dojo. We're talking with John DeRosa, and actually, right before the break, we're answering atheist slogans. That's part of this new free book that is going to come out in a little while. The new edition is still in the works at www.classicaltheism.com. And the first slogan we're tackling is that there's no evidence for the existence of God. Now, John, you tackled the one where you asked the person what was the best argument they heard. They would say none, and then you can present them some evidence. But what? How do you answer the atheist who will say, well, the evidence I found was not very good, you know, it was full of holes, and they might even give you some examples?
I think that's, and honestly, I think that's the most common answer you're going to get as well. You know, I've heard Christians say they just have faith, or that they have to, you know, they prayed once and then something happened, and or the, you know, the design argument from Paley's watchmaker, something like that. And if they present that type of weak evidence, remember, you ask them, what's the best thing you've heard? And if that's all that they respond with, then again, you want to say something like, wow, you know what? I have to agree with you that that is not that great of objective evidence. If that's the best evidence you've heard, I understand why you're skeptical. But can I offer you what I take to be some really good arguments? Because there's objective facts about the world that we can show philosophically point to the existence of God. And that's where you could talk about, hey, have you ever heard the Kalam argument? The universe began to exist. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Or you could talk about the moral argument and some other things that you can practice. If you get really, if you go to classicaltheism.com, you start practicing more. We get into the Aristotelian proof for the existence of God, which is based on the first way of Thomas Aquinas. But the bottom line is you can affirm the person. And this is a great conversational tactic to build rapport. You affirm that that evidence is not very strong, and you offer something more for their consideration. The final option, and I'll just say this briefly, they might respond with something pretty good. They might say, hey, you know what? Well, I've been studying the cosmological argument, and I've been studying the moral argument, but I think they have this flaw in them. I think they fail because of this reason. And that person has done their homework. We have to say, hey, you know what? I really appreciate you did your homework. You looked up these arguments. And if you have studied the argument yourself, you can offer a response. Well, you know, maybe they think the Kalam argument commits the fallacy of composition, or the contingency argument commits the fallacy of composition. These are just common things you hear. We discuss them on the podcast. You can answer them. But if you know the answer, you could say, ah, you know, I've heard that objection before. What do you think of this response? Or at the very worst, in that case, you might have to say, you know what? That's a good food for thought. I'm going to have to go back and study that, but I am going to study it and get back to you, because I think it's a good argument. So if someone says there's no evidence for God's existence, you have to ask them, what's the best evidence you've heard, and what do you think is wrong with it?
Yeah, excellent. That's beautiful, because, right, you, and I like the way you put it, too. It's not like, no, that's wrong because, you know, it's not the fallacy of composition because blah, blah, blah. I like the way how you said, you know, have you ever considered this? So it's like you're looking at a third party's argument, and that takes a lot of the heat out of the argument. It's not like you're wrong and this is why. It's more like, did you ever consider this answer that to that objection?
That's exactly right. And that one of the big things, when you, once you start having these conversations, you're going to see some people get very upset, very heated, very quickly. And you just want to have different tactics and different ways of toning down the conversation. Let them know, hey, you know, I care about you. I think this is important stuff. Let's just talk about it together and get at the truth.
Yeah, very good. Well, why don't we jump to one of the new ones? Go ahead. Why don't you pick a new addition to your list of slogans?
Okay, yeah. So I kind of mixed them all in, so it's hard to know what's new and what's not. But here's one I added. So they might not say there's no evidence for God's existence, but chapter two, this is very common. They'll say faith. Christians believe things on faith, but faith is irrational. it's silly to believe things without evidence or to pretend to know things you don't really know. So you Christians, you're just irrational. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So here's what you got to do. Stick to the questions. And in the introduction, I explained the three generic ways you want to start your question are, what do you mean by that? The second way is, how'd you come to that conclusion? And the third way is, have you ever considered such and such, as you just picked up on? Those are kind of like the three general sentence starters. And then in the specifics, you got to tailor them to the particular case. So in this case, you got to ask this person. They said faith is irrational. Hey, you say faith is irrational, but what do you mean by faith? Can you tell us more? What do you mean by that? Because in all honesty, a lot of time, the person who makes this objection is working with an absolutely defective understanding of what faith is.
Absolutely.
And they'll typically say, yeah, you know what I'm talking about here. They'll typically say something like, well, faith is a belief without any evidence, or faith is believing in spite of all evidence. It's just a blind leap. Yeah. Those are some things that they might say.
Or faith is believing in something you know can't possibly be true.
Well, I mean, that is like, oh my gosh, if that's what it is, then okay, I will admit to you, I don't even want to have faith if that's the case. So you got to start out, get their definition on the board. What do you mean by that? And then you can inform them, hey, you know what? I understand that that's what you're saying faith is, but I think it's a mischaracterization of the traditional Christian position. I don't think faith is like that. And if I did, I'm with you. I wouldn't want to have faith if I think it's that. Instead, you make it sound that Christians have no good reasons to believe any of the things they do. They just believe it by blind faith, and that's that. But that's not the case. And then you have to say, well, have you ever considered this? And then you offer, you know, a better definition. And, in you know, hey, we got a catechism. We're Catholics here. You can go to the catechism when you need some good information. But faith, we consider, is a theological virtue. It's that by which we believe God and all that he has revealed, but it's not a blind impulse of the mind, because faith, so it's a virtue, it involves a trusting and believing in God. That part the atheist has right, that it does involve belief and trust, but the thing is, it's not a blind impulse of the mind, and that's specific wording in the catechism that I'm taking. It's based on motives of credibility. This is a phrase that our church uses, that Christians have used for centuries. In other words, it's based on good reasons to think that God has revealed such and such. So faith, it's not a blind leap into the dark. It's based on the fact that we think God revealed certain things. Why do we think he revealed it? Well, he's given us motives of credibility. We have some miracles to consider. You might – and if the – by the way, we're just talking about what faith is. You don't necessarily have to go into a whole case. I'm just giving you some more background on this. But there's miracles to consider. There's the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. We have very good historical evidence that this occurred. There's other Eucharistic miracles that Catholics can point to, though I wouldn't recommend going there with skeptics in a first conversation. There's other historical miracles, such as the miracle at Fatima, where a lot of atheists and skeptics were present and still acknowledge that something supernatural took place in the sky. So we have some miracles to buttress our position. We have prophecies from the Old Testament that Jesus fulfilled. And then we also have the holiness of the saints, these people who, like Mother Teresa, who just showed such radical holiness in the way that they lived their lives, lend credibility to the fact that God has revealed truth in the Bible, in Scripture, in tradition, and through the church. So faith, if the atheist is correct that it's just blind in spite of the evidence, we don't want to hold it, but we want to ask them, what do you mean by faith? Because my faith is informed by the evidence and flows from it.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that is a very common slogan that, belief in God is just this irrational faith, and excellent. I mean, I love the way you pinpointed, ask them to define faith, because like you said, I found 99 times out of 100, it doesn't even come close to the Catholic position.
Yes, and I'll add actually one more. If you really want to dig into the Catholic position on faith, there's actually a lot of work going on with this now. It's not, I mean, this is something that philosophers are studying and how best to categorize it. But in the Catholic view, so there's some dispute. Not everyone is going to agree with everything that I just said about faith. I think it's pretty broad what I said. I think most Catholics would agree with that. But there's basically two elements. So why is it not irrational? There's kind of two elements that make it not irrational. The first one is that I pointed to. It's based on the motives of credibility. And I kind of just focused on that. But in the Catholic tradition, the other reason it's not irrational is because we believe God exists and that his grace is at work in our act of faith. So that's more of a, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas talks about that. But God actually gives us his divine help to go through with the will, with our will to believe in him. So there's that second aspect. And if we have good reasons to think that God exists, that his grace and supervision extends to all things, that's another reason of why it's not irrational. Now, if you're talking to an atheist, that's not going to mean that much because they're going to say, oh, well, but God doesn't exist. But it just shows us that if God exists, then it's another reason to show that the act of faith is rational because God works with us to help us believe.
Yeah, very good. Excellent. Let's see. We got a couple of minutes to the break. Why don't you throw out another one? Maybe something
that's
pretty short.
Here's a quick one I think we could do. Chapter 5, where is God? Have you ever seen him? No, he's untestable. He's unfalsifiable. Where is this God? And I this is a classic objection. Like, you know, you don't see God under a microscope. The Russians, they went up in the space places wherever they went, and they said, oh, there's no God. There's nothing up here in the heavens. And I like this one because I think you can ask this person a fun question if they're complaining about where is God. The scientists don't see him. Nobody sees him. Here's the question you can ask them, and then we can just briefly go back into this after the break. But when someone says, where is God? Have you seen him? No, he's untestable. He's unfalsifiable. You ask them this. Well, hey, I got a question for you. When you look at the Mona Lisa, you know the Mona Lisa, right? When you're looking at the Mona Lisa, where's the painter?
Ah, yeah.
Just let them think about that for a second. When you're looking at the Mona Lisa, where is the painter? And that question can kind of, hopefully it forces them to think, well, hey, I don't see the painter anywhere. The painter isn't an element within the painting. He's not like hiding over there in the corner or in some layer. God is not some item in the universe. The God of classical theism transcends the universe. He transcends all the created stuff. He's not the type of thing that you're going to find under the microscope, but that doesn't imply that he doesn't exist. Just as the fact that you can't find the painter inside the Mona Lisa, that doesn't imply that the painting has no painter. The painter right. is the creator of the whole painting, just as God is the metaphysically necessary creator and sustainer of our whole universe. So if someone says, where's God? Have you ever seen him? You can ask him. But when you're looking at the Mona Lisa, where's the painter?
Yeah, very good. We're talking with John DeRosa on answering common atheist slogans. More on the other side of the break, folks. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber reminding you there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. We're talking with Master Apologist John DeRosa and going through answering common atheistic slogans. And John's just knocking them out of the park. This is going to be a great book. I can't wait for the new edition to come out, John.
Oh, thanks, Gary. And I've told you before, but I'm going to resist that label, Master Apologist, every time you give it to me, because I am a studious amateur. We're working alongside together, but I appreciate it.
Well, you know, master is a relative term, and if you really know the level of apologetics I know, every guest is a master. So, anyway, you know, the slogan, "Where is God?" That you bring up a really interesting point. I mean, that was a great way to respond. You know, where's the painter in the Mona Lisa, right? But yeah, it's funny how – oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like that it gets at like the type of evidence we're looking for. That's kind of the difference, because if you're only used to thinking about one type of evidence, the type of evidence that you can see in a laboratory, and you don't consider like philosophical evidence or historical evidence, then yes, it is quite hard to come to see God. But once you allow philosophy and history and other things into the ball game, then we can bring out those clues and those arguments that point to God.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, that's very good. In fact, you know, it kind of what I like about this particular slogan is it highlights something that is very common out there, and that is that non-believers often try to use their imagination of what God would be if they were God, and they often make him into a feature of the universe, like this old man dwelling up in the sky somewhere. And so when you say, "Where is God?" that, you know, lurking behind it is that misconception that, you know, God somehow is dwelling within his own creation, you know, outside of the incarnation.
That's such a great point. And it shows that Gary Matsuda is a classical theist, because that's one of our big emphases at the Classical Theism Podcast, is that God is not a creature like we are. He's radically different than us. He's transcendent from us. So you got to get that picture of the old man in the sky, the bearded guy up there. You kind of got to put that out of your mind when you're considering traditional monotheism and Catholic Christianity in particular. But actually, you know what? This is not a bad point to add, Gary. I got a new, it's a free PDF. This you can get right away today. You don't have to enter your email or anything. Classicaltheism.com/talking points. If you're wondering, like, hey, why the heck is John DeRosa, why is he saying classical theism? Why is Gary Matsuda talking about classical theism? Why not just theism? I got a new PDF. It's just about 4 pages, and it goes through what is classical theism and why should we hold to that. So if listeners want to check that out, I thought that'd be a good time to throw that in.
Awesome. That's great. Well, go ahead. Pick another new slogan to your book.
Yeah, this is a brutal one, because you're going to hear this a lot, and it'll just put you, you know, you'll be stuck in the mud if you haven't prepared for it. It's chapter 10 in the new table of contents. But the God of the Bible is an evil maniac who commits atrocity after atrocity. Have you ever heard that one before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, there was a very prominent new atheist that makes that, well, actually a couple of them that make that argument.
I think it might even be all of them. You know, now that I'm
True. Now that I think about it, right.
Dawkins makes that argument. Let's see who else. Christopher Hitchens.
The late Hitchens.
Similar argument. And Trent Horn just debated a few months ago Dan Barker, who you might consider a new atheist. I know he wasn't part of the original four, but that was a prominent piece in their debate. So I'm going to recommend if you're encountering this argument, like the God of the Bible is an evil maniac who commits atrocity after atrocity, if you want to get some more resources for diving into that, I'll have a few pages in my ebook. I'll give you some bullet points, some questions, but check out that debate with Trent Horn and Dan Barker, because Trent has a great approach. He's polished and he's great at responding quick in a debate context.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's been in the dojo a few times. So, yeah, we're more familiar with Trent Horn's work.
Very good. Well, here's the first thing. So how can we approach this? First thing I suggest, you got to ask this person, how did you come to that conclusion? Just start with a general question. You got to get more information. You can't just start going off on a whole thing, because the odds are this person is parroting comments from other atheists that they've heard on the internet or from some passing remarks that they've read in books. So you got to ask, wait a minute. You're saying the God of the Bible is an evil maniac. How did you come to that conclusion? And what specific atrocities do you have in mind? And then before I give you some more points, you can go this route. You don't have to go this route, but you could say, hey, wait a minute. Well, couldn't it be true that the God of the Bible is an evil maniac? You know, that wouldn't show that there is no God, right? Would you agree, Mr. Atheist, that even if it were shown that, as you're saying, the God of the Bible is an evil maniac, that wouldn't prove that atheism is true, right? It might just show that the Bible's not inspired. Now, of course, we don't ultimately agree with that, but I'm just saying that's a tactical approach. You might just see if the person's going to be intellectually honest with you and say, you know what? You're right. At most, it would disprove Christianity. Okay. Then you find out, okay, this person's being honest. They're in the mood for a discussion. But once you get past that point, if you want to make that point, you got to ask them, what specifics do you have in mind? Can you spell it out for me what you mean by the fact that the God of the Bible is being an evil maniac? Mm-hmm. And again, you force them to either reveal that they have done their homework or they have not done their homework. Because at that point, if they have not done their homework, they're not going to have any specific references. They're just going to say something like, ah, well, he just, you know, he killed a bunch of people. He ordered people to rape people. Like, they're just going to throw out things very generally and say, hey, whoa. Wait a minute. You're saying this stuff. Where is that in the Bible? Do you have any references for me? Can you give us some specifics? Just, you kind of want to plant that seed, put that pebble in their shoe, as Trent Horn sometimes likes to say, of, well, listen, you got to do some more homework on this. Get some more specifics. And then you can start to tackle the question. But let's just say the person is able to reference typically the commands to wipe out the Canaanites and other tribes are a common thing that's discussed under here. So let's assume this person's done their homework. They have some reference where God ordered the Israelites to wipe out the Canaanites, every man, woman, child, oxen, and so forth. Let's just say they're able to come up with that reference, okay? So what might you do in this case? And again, it's a tough issue, and there's a lot of different ways to tackle it. I'm just going to give you 2 points to remember, and that's this. One, here's the thing. God is not a human moral agent like we are. We can agree with the objector that if God were just like some super powerful guy, you know, flying around in the sky, arbitrarily killing people, you know, commanding them to do terrible things, just like we are, but like flying around, that would be terrible. Okay, he would be subject to moral censure. But Christians traditionally don't think of God that way. As classical theists, we hold that God is beyond us. His nature is radically different from us. He's the creator of all reality. But as it says in Isaiah, his ways are higher than our ways. And as St. Paul affirms, you know, how inscrutable are his ways? He says that in Romans 11. He asks that question. So God is not, he transcends us. I'll make another point, but he's not a human moral agent. He's the uncreated and unchanging creator. In other words, he can't be evaluated on the same level that we are. He doesn't get better or worse. He's not like a Boy Scout who's like going to get all the merit badges because he did super well. God is already self-sufficient and perfect in himself. So why do I bring this up? Well, again, it would be wrong for humans or human moral agents to do the things that God does in the Old Testament. We don't have the authority. We're not the creators of all that exists. But God is the author of all life. He has the authority to take and give life as he sees fit, and he doesn't owe any of us a long, happy, healthy life, although we might want that. So that's the first point. God's beyond us. He has the authority as the author to give and take life as he sees fit. Now, people are uncomfortable with that. They don't like that idea. So additionally, I would point out this, because it's very distasteful to say that nowadays. Point out God's judgment, that although God's beyond us, he has the authority to take life as he sees fit, point out that God's judgment will be perfect. There will be no mistakes in the final judgment. And I even remember a priest saying something like this to me in college. Like, there's no worry that on a Catholic Christian worldview, God killed a bunch of people or ordered them to be killed, and they're going to end up in the wrong place. No, no, no. If they're saved by grace, by being engrafted into Christ, even if they only lived a short life, they will be given eternal life. And if they die in a state of mortal sin, if they're willfully separated from God, then God's not going to force them into his kingdom against their will. So point out to the person that God's judgment will be perfect. Don't worry that, because I think the worry is Israelites are slaughtering people and there's like some innocent people that are going to get taken away. You don't need to worry about that. God will sort everything out in his perfect final judgment. So I think those two major points can help dispel a little bit about these atrocities. One, God's not a human moral agent that can be judged on the same grounds. And two, his final judgment will be perfect. There will be no mistakes. I'll point out one other thing, and I know this is a big one in the book. It's going to be a little bit longer in this chapter. But some people have done work on literary genre and devices. Trent Horns does this in Hard Sayings. Matthew Ramage has another book on hard sayings. I forget the name at this point. But they point out that there may be reasons to note that this common warfare language in the ancient Near East shouldn't be taken as literal truth. That when they said, we're going to wipe them out, that was more of like a hurrah, we're going to crush the other team type warfare language. So it may not be that all those commands are literal, and they were just commanded to drive the Canaanites out of the land and reclaim it. That's a third thing. You might get into that if you want to really get biblical, but hopefully those are some points that you can use in conversation when someone says the God of the Bible is an evil maniac.
Yeah, that's very good, man. That was three homers, I think, one after the other. What was I going to say? Yeah, in fact, I think there is a steel somewhere. This is an inscription. It might be Babylonian, where it's the king states that he totally wiped out the Israelites, utterly destroyed them. And it's like, well, you know, I'm pretty sure there's still Israelites around today. Yeah, you're right. It's like this war rhetoric.
That's great stuff. And you hear it with the Canaanites, too, because they say to wipe out the Canaanites, but then you actually find out in later chapters.
They're still around.
There's still Canaanites walking around.
But I
like to take the strongest case. Dialectically, yeah. I would say let's just assume that these are literal, and let's still show how it doesn't prove what they think it does.
Yeah, and that's why I call you a master apologist, John, because you are a master apologist. I can't believe the hour is gone. Can you tell people where they can go and get all the great programs from you?
Sure. Thank you. Gary, it's always a pleasure to be here. ClassicalTheism.com. is the website. You can get the free book, and classicaltheism.com/talking points. You can get those free PDFs on what is classical theism and why we should hold to it. Thanks so much for having me on, and I can't wait to be on again.
Well, thank you. Wow, that's great stuff. Thanks, John. That's John DeRosa, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, check out classicaltheism.com. He's got so many great videos, audio, and like you said, talking points. If you're dealing with non-believers, that's the place to go, because it's a great way to get a lot of information quickly. Man, it's time to shut down the Midwest Command Center and turn off the dojo lights here. As always, coming up next, the show that started it all, folks, the Terry and Jesse Show. And I hope everybody has a great holiday. God willing, we will talk to you again soon. God bless everybody. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.